He was a cruel man, hardened by a long life of slaveholding. He would at times seem to take great pleasure in whipping a slave. I have often been awakened at the dawn of day by the most heart-rending shrieks of an own aunt of mine, whom he used to tie up to a joist and whip upon her naked back till she was literally covered with blood. No words, no tears, no prayers from his gory victim seemed to move his iron heart from its bloody purpose. The louder she screamed, the harder he whipped. And where the blood ran fastest, there he whipped longest. He would whip her to make her scream, and whip her to make her hush. And not until overcome by fatigue would he cease to swing the blood-clotted cowskin. I remember the first time I ever witnessed this horrible exhibition. I was quite a child, but I well remember it. I never shall forget it whilst I remember anything. It was the first of a long series of outrages of which I was doomed to be a witness and a participant. It struck me with awful force. It was the blood-stained gate, the entrance to the hell of slavery, through which I was about to pass. It was a most terrible spectacle. I wish I could commit to paper the feelings with which I beheld it. Eyewitness account of slavery. The kind of slavery that you and I would most likely think of when we hear the word slavery. A slavery where people are kidnapped from their home, taken against their will somewhere, treated brutally in another land. That's what many of us think of when we think of slavery. So you can imagine the outrage of people when they open up a Bible, not knowing God, not knowing the rest of the Bible at all, and they see instructions to slaves. Instructions that don't say, hey, you should overturn the government. You should be fighting. You should be marching in the streets to end this thing called slavery. Instead, what they find are instructions on how to be a better slave. I've had people ask me, how come the Bible is so pro-slavery? And I've had to tell them, you obviously don't know the Bible very well. But you do understand, if you don't know the Bible well, this passage that we're looking at this morning could be terribly troubling and offensive. The idea of giving instructions on how to be a good slave seemed to be unbelievable, unconscionable, reprehensible. And one more reason for someone to say, I don't believe in God. How could a good and loving God give instructions to slaves on how to be better slaves? There are some things that most people don't know about slavery. And I want to just run through a few of them rather quickly. Some mostly unknown facts about slavery. You might know some of this, and you might not. The first of all, is when this passage was written in the first century, slavery was very different than what you and I are used to reading about, even in that text that I just read. First century slaves were often treated very well. They would live in the house with their slave owner. Now, granted, no one wanted to be a slave. It wasn't something people were signing up for. Back in those days, slavery wasn't so much about kidnapping as it was about paying off a debt. You had a debt you had to pay, and the only way that you could pay that debt was to sell yourself to the person you owed the money to until you paid off that debt. So they would often live in the same house as their slave owner, while people who were free would sometimes live in the street and beg for food. First century slavery was different. Second of all, Christians have always influenced slavery. Christianity is the only major religion on the planet that has consistently pushed against the institution of slavery, right from the get-go. Christians have influenced slavery. In fact, you might know this, but the reason that there is not widespread slavery in Canada and the United States is largely, almost exclusively, due to the church, people in the church fighting against it. Another thing, slaves were common back then. There was often more slaves than there were free people back in the first century. If you had a city, a lot of those people are going to be slaves. And slaves would flock to the church, as did a lot of oppressed groups, which is why a lot of women ended up in the church, because there was freedom there that they couldn't find in society. There was equality there that they couldn't find in society. So the first century church was filled with slaves and women. Number four, you might not know this, the New Testament actually condemns slave traders and says this is a terrible, terrible sin. So it does actually condemn this thing. Now, I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about the institution of slavery. That's a whole other issue. But what are we to do with this passage? What are we to do with these passages in the Bible that talk about how to be good slaves? You just skip over them? Is that what we're supposed to do? It's like, well, this doesn't apply to me. I'm not a slave, so on you go. Actually, there's some great principles in there. And in this passage this morning, there are great principles that are perfect for those of us who are employees. Anybody here and an employee? Oh, some of you have jobs. That's good. I'm glad you have somewhere to go tomorrow morning. But this passage goes even beyond being an employee. And as we look at this, you are going to see how this passage affects all relationships. And if you have relationships with anyone, this message is going to have something in it for you. But it is directed primarily to slaves. And I hope for those of us who are employed, my hope is in this message that you will see your job as more than a money delivery system, and more than a matter of pride, and more than a thief of your time. I'm hoping that you will be able to see that your job is, in fact, a ministry. Your job is a ministry. So, continuing on, we're going to go back over 1 Peter 2, 18 through 25, where Peter, and this is Peter the fisherman, Peter the apostle of Jesus, who followed Jesus for 3 years, this is 30 years now, Jesus has been gone from the planet, and he's writing a letter towards the very end of his life to the churches scattered throughout modern-day Turkey. And these are churches who are suffering. These are people who are being persecuted for their faith. And he's writing them a message of hope. And in it, he addresses specifically slaves. And this is what he says. And I gotta say, the first verse might be the toughest to swallow. Are you ready? Here we go. You who are slaves must accept the authority of your masters with all respect. Do what they tell you. Not only if they are kind and reasonable, but even if they are cruel. Well, I'm sure we could have a good discussion just on that, couldn't we? Because if your picture is slavery from the 19th century or the 18th century, you're going, what? That has got to be a typo. Peter was out to lunch that day. I don't know what he was thinking when he wrote this. This is hard. It looks like the Bible is endorsing slavery. He's saying even when the masters are cruel, you need to do what they tell you to. That can't seem right. So let's back up a bit. before the first century, in the Old Testament, we have a lot of examples where the law was changed. The law was changed. In fact, the law was given. And the law did not change people's hearts. And you'd have good kings come along and they'd, you know, try to follow the law, and people would kind of play along until that king was dead, and then right back to what they were doing before, worshiping idols and all that sort of thing. Changing the law does not change people's hearts. And then you get to the New Testament, the New Covenant. And the emphasis seems to be on changing people's hearts in order to change the society. Knowing that, this passage is not so much about changing the institution of slavery as teaching slaves how to conduct themselves as followers of Jesus in that institution. And here's something that is unique to Christianity. I mean, it's really easy to follow a boss who's nice. Try following a boss who's a jerk. Anyone ever had a jerk for a boss? Yeah, you know what it's like then. It is hard. They might treat you like garbage. Total disrespect. And here's something unique to Christianity. It says you are not only to obey bosses who are nice, you are to obey bosses who are jerks. Love your enemies, Jesus taught. Oh, that's a tough pill to swallow, is it not? I mean, if you can't tell me that's a tough pill to swallow, you've never tried it. Try loving someone. Try obeying someone who's a jerk to you. It's hard. It is really hard. That's exactly what we are told to do. So, now we already think Peter's off his rocker. He's going to continue on. He says, "For God is pleased with you," you, the church, "God is pleased with you, the church, when you, the church, do what you know is right and patiently endure unfair treatment." Listening to your boss, doing what your boss wants you to do, can be very tough. But here's the deal. It says God is pleased with you when you do it. Isn't that nice that you can give God pleasure? He can delight in you. You want to make God smile? Follow a jerk for a boss. No one's going to re-listen to this on the internet, I'm sure. You know, you're going to tell them that was the message that he went, woo! Okay. But we all know that you can suffer for doing what is right, but Peter's also going to address something else. He says, of course, you get no credit. You get no credit for being patient if you are beaten for doing wrong. But if you suffer for doing good and you endure it patiently, God is pleased with you. He's reminding you that, well, there's really a couple kind of sufferings you could endure at work. One is for doing the right thing, and one is for doing the wrong thing. I won't get you to put your hands up, but I'll bet you some of us have suffered at work because we've done the wrong thing. Oh, yeah. It is sometimes hard at work to do things we don't want to. And there is a real temptation there. Some things can be aggravating. As Malcolm Forbes, a publisher of Forbes magazine, said, he said, if you have a job without aggravations, you don't have a job. So, on the doing wrong list, what are some doing wrong things that we can do at work? Dressing that way may be one of them. But what are some of the things that we can do wrong that we will suffer for if we do them at work? Well, it's things like, on the doing wrong list, stealing time. You know, goofing off, texting, whatever, you know, when we're supposed to be working, stealing time. Might suffer for that. Low effort. Staying on task may be difficult. Or you may even be on task, but you're taking your dear, sweet time, dragging your feet. Ever done that? You may suffer for that. Lateness, showing up late. I'll just run through these quickly. Mouthing off. No one in here would do that, right? Slander, talking about the boss behind his back. That lousy woman, I don't know why, you know, and all that good stuff. Being argumentative with the boss might make some suffering at work. If you want to play devil's advocate, maybe with your boss is not the right person to do that with. Complaining. Are you known as the complainer at work? Or how about just, I'm just not going to do that. Are you that person? Yeah, just not going to do that. All of these will not win you Christian of the Year. I thought that was clever, man. But why? He's going to get to why should we listen to the boss then? What's the purpose? And this is, he's building up to what I think is such a beautiful statement. When it comes to not only employees, but in all relationships. And now he's going to start to dig down deep into this. I love this. This was so rich. He says, for God called you, the church, you, to do good, even if it means suffering. Just as Christ suffered for you. He is your example. And you must follow in his steps. I think sometimes when people are invited to follow Jesus, this is our mission, inviting people to follow Jesus. Sometimes when Christians invite others to follow Jesus, they make it sound like it's going to be Disneyland. All your problems will go away. Your bank account will go up. Your problems will go down. That's the line a lot of people are given. This is what happens when you follow Jesus. This passage, this passage is hard to swallow. It says, Jesus is our example. What did he do? He suffered. And we are to follow in his footsteps. Suffer for doing good. And here's the principle in this verse. And you can take this home. And you can munch on this all day long. Doing good will not always feel good. Think about that for a moment. Doing good will not always feel good. This is so important for everyone to understand in this room. Doing good will not always feel good. And he goes on, and he's going to dig a little deeper now. And he's going to, I love the point that he's making here. He says, Jesus never sinned, nor ever deceived anyone. I mentioned this last week, but it's hard for me to imagine that there was a time on this planet where someone lived who never sinned. No ego? Didn't exaggerate stories to make a point, didn't unfairly judge people, didn't talk about them behind their back, never sinned, never deceived anyone, never stole anything. I think one of the most astounding points of Jesus' life, and I encourage you once again, if you have not read the four biographies of Jesus' life, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, please read them. One of the most astounding moments in all of those biographies is found in the book of John. And Jesus is standing before his enemies. These are people who are highly motivated to take him down. And he asks one simple question that haunts me. He says, who of you can accuse me of sin? Opens it up. Says, can anyone tell me where I've sinned? Can anyone show me where I've sinned? And these enemies, these were religious people. They knew the moral law, had it memorized. If anyone could have pointed out something where Jesus messed up, they could have. Not only was it astounding that Jesus asked the question, it was astounding that they were dumbfounded. They had no answer. Couldn't come up with anything. Now, I would never have the guts to ask, which of you could show me my sin? Because many of you would come up to say, well, I could put it in a spreadsheet for you. Maybe a pie chart. How about a PowerPoint presentation with some nice graphics? You could go to my wife, first of all. She could tell you a whole list. My family of origin, my kids could tell you. Every church I've been a pastor of or have attended could give you a long list of evidence pointing to the fact that I am a broken down sinner. I suspect they could probably do the same for you. Who of us could ever have the guts to say, come on, family, come on, wife, come on, friend, husband, show me my sin. Show me where I've ever sinned. Could you imagine? But Jesus did that, and no one had an answer. Not even his enemies, who wanted to have an answer. Believe me, they wanted to have an answer. And this brings us to the points. And the application of this passage is coming right up. And if you do these three things, it will change your life forever, I guarantee it. And first of all is this. Compare your bills. See, when someone creates suffering in our lives, whatever it may be, our natural reaction is to think this one thought, you owe me. We may not say it, but we will think it and we will feel it. You owe me. There's a debt to be paid, and it can grow over time. The anger towards the government or your boss or your kids or the world, you owe me. There's a gap between what I got and what I deserve. That gap is the bill. You owe me. And no doubt, Peter's writing to slaves, and their boss owes them. And he's telling them, he said, compare your bill. What that means is, Jesus lived a perfect life. He just made that point. Jesus never sinned. He never deceived anyone. Jesus lived an infinitely better life than any of us in this room. And he was treated infinitely worse than anyone in this room. So he's saying, before you get all uppity about the bill that's owed you, compare your bill, what's owed you, to the injustice of what Jesus went through. Because he had it way worse than any of us in this room. You want to know about suffering? God suffered for us. Isn't that cool? Jesus was willing to suffer for us. So compare your bills. Peter continues on. He said, he did not retaliate when he was insulted, nor threaten revenge when he suffered. He left his case in the hands of God, who always judges fairly. That brings us to the second thing that we do. So first of all, we compare our bills, but second of all, we transfer debt collection. That's kind of funny, you know. I've mentioned before that one of my vices is I like to watch cop shows, the real live cop shows, and I love it when people get arrested, and it's on tape even, you know. It's documented exactly what they did, and they'll say things like, I'll have your badge. You don't know who you're dealing with. Ever said those things? In other words, I vow revenge. I want to collect on this debt. You are causing me suffering. I think Shakespeare got it very right, and I've used this quote before. I love this one. From The Merchant of Venice, he said, if you prick us, do we not bleed? If you poison us, do we not die? And if you wrong us, shall we not revenge? Isn't that a good picture of human nature? Isn't that just natural? You want to get back. You want to get even. And how many movies have been based around the idea of revenge? So we're going to have a little fun here this morning. I have three movie stills, all of them regarding revenge. And I want to see if you know the magic line that goes along with that still. And I have to admit, the first one's the hardest, and you kind of have to be a diehard nerd like me in order to get it. So if you're not a nerd, I'm sorry. Wrath of Khan. And he quotes Shakespeare again, I believe. Does anyone know the line before I give you a hint? What is it? Oh, my fellow nerd. Revenge is a dish best served cold. Thank you so much. I didn't know if anyone would get that one. That's awesome. Yes, there it is. Revenge is a dish best served cold. Here's another one, a little easier. I'll be back. Yes. And I don't think he was implying that he was bringing roses, if you know what I mean. And finally, and here's another, this is my favorite one. I love this one, and most of you are going to get this one, I think. What is it? Yeah, who said it? Oh, my fellow nerd again. Say it out loud so everyone can hear. I'll get you, my pretty. That's right. Yes, the original WWW, before the World Wide Web. It was the Wicked Witch of the West. Yes, she said, I'll get you, my pretty. Revenge is something that just comes naturally to us. We want to do that, but that's not what Jesus did. Instead of revenge, Jesus took that whole bill, everything that he was owed, all the unfairness in his life, and believe me, there was a lot of unfairness. He didn't deserve anything, any of the suffering that he went through, didn't deserve any of it. And instead of collecting on it himself, and believe me, he could have. If anyone could have said, I'll have your badge, it was Jesus. He took that whole debt, that whole unfairness, and he handed it over to his Father, and he said, I trust you to deal with it. And my friends, I'll tell you, some of us in this room right now are carrying a debt that we think is owed to us, and it will never be repaid. And the most freeing thing you could do is bundle that all up, as hard as it may be, because some of us have been hurt deeply and personally. Bundle that all up, hand it over to the Father and say, I trust you. You're a much better judge, and you're far more capable of taking someone's badge than I am. Now, he's going to conclude this section with just this beautiful summary. I love this. And I just want you to soak it in as I read it. He said, Jesus personally carried our sins in his body on the cross so that we can be dead to sin and live for what is right. Now stop just a moment. Just pay attention to me for a second. A lot of us have been taught that Jesus died on a cross just so we can go to heaven. That's definitely part of it. No denying that. But look at what this passage says. He personally carried our sins in his body on the cross. Why? So that we, the church, so that we can be dead to sin and live for what is right. The benefits of the cross begin immediately. There is a freedom from sin. We are no longer bound to have to sin. And we are free to do good in the world. We are free to be light, to bring joy, to bring peace, to bring love into this world. That's what Jesus did on the cross. And then it says, by his wounds, you are healed. Once you were like sheep who wandered away, but now, now you have turned to your shepherd, the guardian. I love that word. The guardian of your souls. What's his point? Because it's easy to miss, is this. Get a cause. I want to just hover here for a second, because it'd be so easy to read that passage and go, well, that was really nice, but I don't know what that has to do with slaves. I don't know what that has to do with going to work tomorrow. I don't understand what this has to do with my life. Understand the point that Peter is making here. He's saying, ultimately, that your job is a ministry. And the cause is inviting people to follow Jesus. You see, Jesus chose to suffer. He chose to do what is right, and he suffered for it. And here's the important part. And other people benefited from it. He didn't suffer for his own benefit. He suffered for the benefit of others. Are you getting the connection now? When we do right at work, and we suffer at work, we have to understand that that suffering is for the benefit of others. For our coworkers, for our boss, they are watching you. As a follower of Jesus, they are watching you. How are you going to handle being treated like a slave? How are you going to handle that jerk of a boss? Beyond work, how are you going to handle that jerk neighbor? That jerk spouse? That jerk kid? That jerk friend? What are you going to do with that? People are watching. Not just is your job a ministry, all relationships are a ministry. When you do right and suffer, it benefits others. It says, Jesus is our example. Aren't you glad? If you're a follower of Jesus, you already have answered this question, but aren't you glad? Jesus decided to suffer for the benefit of others. If he didn't, none of us would be here. Our calling as followers of Jesus is to do what Jesus did. And Jesus went to the cross. He was willing to even die for the benefit of others. And that theme is picked up in the rest of the New Testament. A lot of people mistakenly believe there are two types of work. There's sacred work and there's secular work. Sacred work is what I do. See, I got the good job. I got the fancy education and the little piece of paper on the wall that says, I'm a holy dude. And you should all listen to me. And I have the sacred work. And you know, if you're a really good Christian, you'll become a missionary, which I think is a step above being a pastor, you know. Sometimes I wonder. And so we look at pastor and missionary and we go, well, that's sacred work. That's God's work. And it's too bad here I am at the checkout in Walmart putting in my tithe. This passage says there is no sacred and secular work. It is all sacred. Every job you have is a ministry because people are watching you. And you have the opportunity to do good. You have the opportunity to do good and suffer for it just as Jesus did good and suffered for it. And people will see that and maybe get a glimpse into who Jesus is and how much God loves them. Remember, he's writing to a suffering church, and Peter said, compare your bills with Jesus. Compare your injustice in your life to the injustice that Jesus suffered. And then transfer that debt. Transfer all that is owed you, all that injustice. And many of us have great injustices against us. Hand that over to the Father. Hand that over and say, you take care of it. And number three, get a cause. Understand that your life is a ministry. Everywhere you go is a ministry. Your family is a ministry. Your neighborhood is a ministry. Your workplace is a ministry, because you represent, as Jesus, as a follower of Jesus, you represent him wherever you go. You never can turn it off. It's always there. There's never been, by the way, I think, a greater time. If you have a jerk for a boss, by the way, there's never been a greater time than 2019 to meet hate with love, to meet darkness with light, to meet oppression with forgiveness. Because in today's world, that will stand out. When you can love people who are awful to you, that is the mark of a follower of Jesus. Anyone can be nice to people who are nice to you, but a follower of Jesus is nice to even oppressive and cruel people, and serves them and loves them. This is why the New Testament says, whatever you do, do it for God's glory. Do it for him. Whatever you do. It doesn't matter if you're a doctor or a checkout clerk. It doesn't matter what your occupation is. Do it for Jesus. And maybe you're not employed here this morning and you're starting to tune out. Let me tell you, you have a ministry where you live. You have a ministry in your family, and people are watching you. Are you willing to suffer for doing what is right? And it's hard sometimes to do the right thing. Jesus loved with full grace and full truth. To have both of those to the max is hard, and it will cost you. It will. It will cost you. It cost him. My friends, a job is a ministry. And in a moment, we're going to sing a song called I Will Follow. And my hope here this morning is that you understand what I will follow means. It doesn't mean I'll follow you, Jesus, as long as it gets me into a good job, and as long as it gets me into a happy marriage, and as long as all my kids behave, and as long as I'm in a good neighborhood where no one ever gets robbed, and so on and so on and so on. But I will follow you and do the right thing, even if it means suffering. That's what it means to follow Jesus. And as one final thought, as I finished this message, I had to smile to myself, because I just had to praise God that in his kingdom, the gate is wide open even for jerk bosses. Even for mean people. And it's a good thing, or the gate would not be open for me. Let's sing. If you would like prayer for anything, please come on up here, and there'll be people here to pray with you. Other than that, God bless you, and we'll see you again.